wouldn't call it Snowmageddon or anything, but it's pretty much our first day of snow across most of North Dakota. Hope you're keeping it safe out there driving today. I'm Eric Dethridge. Welcome to Main Street. I'll be in the hosting chair for Craig Blumenschein this week, although in the second half of the show, you'll hear from Craig as he pauses his vacation to talk about a very important issue to parents and kids, free school lunches. And we'll talk to a UND aviation student who is poised to become the first female commercial pilot in her home country of Mali. But first, we're going to talk to a couple of people about art as a form of remembrance. On this week of Thanksgiving, we're reflecting on unfilled seats at our tables, family and friends who can't be with us. We're exploring the idea of grief when it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic, public grief, private grief, and wondering if someday we as a community, state, and nation will ever memorialize those that died from COVID or things related to it. One person that did memorialize people in our region who passed away from COVID is Western North Dakota artist Daphne Clark. Hi, Daphne.
Hi.
Well, first off, tell us where you grew up and how that impacted your early childhood, your eventual academic and career pursuits as well.
Well, I grew up in East Fairview, which is a border town with Montana and North Dakota. So I grew up on the North Dakota side, but attended some of school on the Montana side. So I have like that deep connection to both North Dakota and Montana and our rural areas.
Well, and eventually you wound up at Minot State and you got a degree in biology, which makes sense because you spent a lot of time on your family's ranch, right?
Yes. Growing up, I spent a lot of time on my grandparents' ranch. They were cattle ranchers and, you know, in the typical hills of North Dakota, and helped them with raising those cattle and doing vaccinations and things like that.
Well, eventually you wound up as an environmental health practitioner. What exactly is that?
So I work at local public health at the Upper Missouri District Health Unit is my day job. And in environmental health, that is like the food inspectors and the people that go out and do food inspections, septic systems and things like that.
Well, in sort of in that vein, too, just the land that you live on and the different industries, ranching and oil, big oil. Talk about that tension out in Western North Dakota between oil interests and ranch interests and that environment you grew up in and worked in.
Yeah. So growing up, you know, Northwestern North Dakota was a quiet place. I mean, we had the oil boom in the 80s, but, things settled back down and it was a quiet and peaceful area to grow up in. But I did work in public health when we had the oil boom happen and that very large growth that happened in 2008, 2009 through like 2012. And the impact that that had on our ranches and our farming areas in North Dakota and how it even just like the trucks driving and the dust would impact the cattle and the plants that were growing and how we're losing some of that rural nature of the farming and ranching community.
Tell us how you got into oil painting specifically and what are the stories that you're trying to tell through your artwork?
Well, I used to be a long distance runner, but I had an injury and I couldn't do that anymore. And so I was looking for something to fill that space for stress relief during the oil boom, because, you know, you need to have something, some release to relieve that stress. And funny enough, I watched a PBS special on a painter and I thought, oh, I could do that. And then I tried and I found out, no, I could not do that. And so then a friend of mine was like, well, you know, he's painting with oil paints and you're using acrylic. And I went, oh, okay. So I went and bought oil paints and I tried again. I still couldn't do that, but it was a little bit better. But then I was hooked. And then I wanted feedback. And there's not a lot of feedback in Northwestern North Dakota. Like, you know, your family is like, oh, yeah, that's great. But I wanted somebody who would pick it apart and make me better.
Sure.
So I fell into an online program at Academy of Art University out of San Francisco and worked on a master's degree over 7 years. It took me to finish that.
Wow. Wow. So what is oil painting versus acrylic versus any kind of other painting? What does that bring out?
Well, the oil paints that I use, I'm able to capture like those North Dakota colors. Like when I finally figured out how to mix North Dakota sky color, because our skies here in North Dakota are one of our best things, right?
That's like amazing.
Yeah, it's a North Dakota treasure. And so when I finally came across the right mixture of mixing together those colors and being able to tell that North Dakota sky color to other people, I was just so excited. And I can only do that in oil paint.
Well, yeah, the colors are quite stunning and quite evocative of our region. So tell the listeners exactly kind of what your paintings look like and describe your process making this art. Do you go out with a blank canvas and paint, or do you take photos and do it later? How does that work?
I do a mixture of both. I will go out and paint plein air is what we call it, when we just go and paint outside and set up. What you're trying to do is trying to get like those colors and how it actually looks in North Dakota. And then sometimes I also take pictures, and I'll take multiple pictures. And then sometimes I put the different pieces of that together to make a larger work. And I let both the outdoor paintings and the indoor paintings inform what I'm doing there. And like I said, I like to try to get that North Dakota sky. I paint a lot of bison from here in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. I paint a lot of the cattle ranching. I like to paint the wild horses from the South unit also. I do paint North Dakota art.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge, and we are chatting with Daphne Clark, a Western North Dakota oil painter. And you can check out some of her stunning artwork, by the way, at daphneclarkart.com. Let's jump to that subject of the global pandemic. Talk about it's complicated, you know, like the oil business and ranch land, but COVID-19 obviously was a complicated thing that we all experienced all over the world. But what was your experience with COVID out in Western North Dakota?
Yeah, so because I work in public health and then I'm also an artist, I was very busy during that time. And there wasn't a lot of time for reflection, but we were losing people during that time. And as working in public health, we were doing information out to the public first, and then we started doing testing, and then eventually we did vaccination. But during that time, I also was losing some people that I had worked with for a long time, or some friends and family. And what I felt was like we were getting lost in the numbers as a whole, the whole community. Like we'd give numbers, the state would give numbers, but that's so far removed from like who the people were, like the people that we were losing in our community. So I had applied for a grant and did the COVID portrait project, where we in Northwest North Dakota paired artists with families who lost somebody to do a portrait of that person for those family or friends, to try to put a face to the people that we had lost, that they weren't just numbers. Mm.
Part of the grant was you recruited some fellow artists to help you with this project, right?
Yes, we had artists from Fargo. We had some in Northwest North Dakota, and we actually had one artist from Savannah, Georgia, who participated in the project. The grant paid them a $100 stipend, which helped cover their fees for, you know, supplies and things like that to make the project or to make the portrait. But I mean, they really were giving of their time and skills. Like there was donation on their part there.
Yeah, definitely. And so I'm just trying to picture, because I've experienced a loss of my family, my father. And when I did, the funeral home, they part of the package was they created a portrait. You know, it wasn't bad. They did it out of a photograph. But what's the difference between something like that and memorializing that individual who passed away from COVID via an artist that's using some of the materials that you would use?
I think part of, you know, that what makes that special is it comes from that human touch, that human hand. And it's part of the interpretation of that person being put into that art. So besides just having the reference pictures of like, here's the pictures of my loved one, we had the family members fill out a form that talked about like, this is what they liked. This was what made them special. And the artists were able to incorporate that, those extra pieces into the pieces of artwork that I think just gives it that more human touch, and just makes it a little bit more special.
And of course, you were one of the artists that painted a portrait of somebody that passed away from COVID for their families. What was your experience like with the family during this process? And what have you heard from them since about what that portrait means to them?
Yeah, and I specifically, a little bit, I don't know, selfish on my part, I handpicked the family that I wanted to do because it was somebody I had worked with in my entire career in public health. And, you know, it impacted me a lot when that person passed away. And so I reached out to the family specifically and was like, I really want you to participate in this. And I really want to be the one that does the portrait. And they're kind of a private family. So it was like, oh, I don't know how much I want to share, you know, But for me, it was cathartic to paint that portrait, for me to put my emotions into that painting. And then the family, when they received the portrait, like just one person from the family originally came to when we gave the paintings or the artworks to the families. And then she saw it and she called more family members. And she's like, I need you to come here for this. And then we ended up with quite a large group there because like they felt it was so special to have that piece. And then they did tell me later, like they've got it hung up in a prominent place and they look at it, you know, every day. And it helps the lessen that loss for them.
And so I know you're not a politician, Daphne, but you were on the ground during COVID-19, both as a public health professional and as an artist and friend and neighbor. You know, we're doing a story about COVID-19 grieving, and there's one place in the country that I know well that is doing that in a very public way. Do you think it says anything at all about North Dakotans who, you know, generally I would say are very private, stoic, maybe individuals? Does it say anything about grieving privately versus publicly? And you know, do you think there's any sort of underlying reason why there isn't a COVID memorial for the public to stop and reflect at?
Yeah, I've given this quite a bit of thought. I think part of it is the controversy around COVID itself. You know, there was people who didn't believe it was real. And, you know, I think some people don't want to admit, like, that's how I lost my person, right? Because maybe my neighbor will be like, well, no, that's not it, you know? And I think that affects some of that. And then I think, you know, some of it is private. People, we are a hearty group of private people. And so we want to keep our struggles to ourselves, I think, sometimes. And so I think we don't, like, I don't want you to know my struggle. And I don't want you to know that that's how I lost my family member. And another piece I've been thinking about is, I think because we are such a hardworking state, I mean, that comes up all the time in the statistics, right? North Dakota is the hardest working state. Mm-hmm. I think we think of art as a luxury. And especially like community art. We don't want to place a value and place money on that because it's like, well, that's frivolous. That's an extra, you know, bonus that maybe we don't need when we could be spending it on the things that we do need. And I think that impacts some of that.
That is an incredibly nuanced answer. Thank you for that. Very well thought out. So Daphne, tell us what you are doing now and how people can find and view your work.
I'm still creating artwork and I'm still trying to find ways to use art to make our communities better places. So I have actually been working on a art in public health master's certificate. So to incorporate using art to improve people's lives. And so one of the ways that we did that over here is using an art piece to promote a mental wellness site that the health unit has sponsored for this area. And yeah, looking at ways of expanding that and then continuing to create art for people.
Wow. Well, it's Daphne Clark, painter, sculptor. If you go to her website again, DaphneClarkArt.com, you can see her stunning portraits of life in western North Dakota near the Montana border. People, the landscape, animals, everyday ranch scenes. And you teach oil painting classes too, right?
Yes, I've been teaching some oil painting classes and branching out into teaching some sculpture. I figure if I want people to create art with, then I need to bring them along with me.
Well, Daphne, what you're doing is fantastic. Thanks for joining us on Main Street today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, in partnership with the Good Relatives, announcing the 2025 Bush Prize Native Nations honorees, Minneapolis American Indian Center, Mokoche Agriculture Development, and Turtle Mountain Impact. Learn more at goodrelativescollaborative.org. It's Main Street on this snowy Tuesday. I'm Eric Dethridge, and you'll forgive me for the self-indulgence, but I recently read how the county where I'm from, Howard County, Maryland, which is close to Baltimore and near D.C., its largest city, Columbia, about the size of Fargo, was a pioneer in post-segregation diversity efforts, last month unveiled a statue in remembrance to those who were lost due to COVID-19. Dr. Calvin Ball is Howard County's first African-American county executive. He was elected in 2018. He's in his second term, and he spearheaded the effort for the COVID memorial. So, Dr. Ball, how did the idea for a COVID memorial in Howard County materialize?
Well, I've been talking to people who were impacted. Howard County lost 394 people that we know of due to the pandemic. But that's not only just 394 people, that's 394 lives, 394 families, communities, lights that will never shine again.
The pandemic obviously took a severe toll on every community in the country, uniquely in a lot of places. So what were the unique impacts to Howard County? I know, of course, that was an epicenter for the after effects of 9/11. How did the pandemic affect your community?
Our proximity to Baltimore and D.C. were almost right in the middle of the Baltimore-Washington region. And Howard County is unique in that we're the only county in the state of Maryland that does not touch another state or body of water. So we are at the core, the heart of Maryland, and we're so close to Washington. We saw not only the political implications and impacts, but the people impacts, and working through not only the loss, but the people who were sick, who sometimes are still suffering with long COVID, our students who during some of their most formative years didn't get an opportunity to learn how to have healthy relationships. We're seeing the impacts of the pandemic now, and we will for years.
So who all is this COVID-19 memorial for?
Well, the memorial, frankly, is for everyone who has suffered a loss, whether that was a loss in life or a loss in livelihood. This memorial is not only a demonstration of the resilience that we showed during those dark days and beyond, and how we got to understand the horrific virus, but also how we came together as one, how we can now reflect silently on those sacrifices, even our first responders who went in when many of us ran out.
So many ran out, including, of course, you know, essential workers that kept us fed. Remember the getting the groceries and having to spray them down? There were a lot of brave people that were doing things that we would consider mundane now and take for granted.
That's right. My parents, who are still down the road in the house where I grew up, my dad has since passed, but once the pandemic hit, I called them. I said, I don't want you leaving the house. And so I got their groceries. I ran the errands. And as things got a little bit better, I still took them to their doctor's appointments. And so I know the impact from a son. My wife is also a registered nurse. And so while she had been in administration, she got pulled right back to the front lines and was wearing her scrubs. And we were working through how we could keep our daughters safe and keep ourselves safe while she was on the front lines.
I mean, that, and that speaks to the lasting impacts of mental health. I know it was traumatizing for me, and especially for my now 93-year-old mother, who was living in Vantage House down there in downtown Columbia for a time. And of course, she was isolated from the world. We did things like Zoom calls every day. I Instacarted her groceries all the time. But, you know, not having that human touch, that human interaction, that was a lasting trauma.
Well, not only was that a lasting trauma, but there are so many families who, when they lost their loved ones during the pandemic, they had to watch them take their last breaths on Zoom. They couldn't comfort them during those challenging times. They couldn't be with them in the meaningful way. And that's really painful for families. It's really painful for our entire community.
There are some people that would say, hey, you know, I would just like this to be in our rearview mirror. I don't want to think about lockdowns and masks and social distancing, and not to mention the whole division over vaccines. So why did you think that it was necessary to commission this sculpture? How did you overcome that sort of thought?
It happened to us. It happened to our community, our nation, our world. And we're going to have to deal with that. Avoiding and hiding from our trauma, our pain, our challenges doesn't make it go away. And it doesn't help us in our healing journey. And frankly, it can be even more isolating.
Dr. Ball, could you describe through our medium of radio the memorial itself, what it looks like, the features that surround it?
Well, first, we planted a grove of 44 native birch trees. Those trees are native to Howard County. And they were selected for their symbolism of renewal, their symbolism of growth. And those birch trees are not only resilient and well-suited for our environment, but they mark the changing of the seasons with grace as we go through the seasons of our lives and think about the seasons of the pandemic. They have glossy green summer leaves that turn into majestic golden hue each fall. And then we also have a peaceful seating area. The area is around a polished black granite water feature. And that reflective surface mirrors the trees, the sculpture, the sky above. And during the spring and summer, you can hear almost a whisper of the water that reminds us of what was, what is, and what can be. And when the fountain is off and the water is still, you can still see the reflection to the sky, the heavens. And then there's a 16-foot tall sculpture, and it welcomes visitors from near and far. And that remarkable work of art honors not only the lives lost, but also pays tribute to the healthcare workers, the essential staff, the community members who carried us through some of our darkest days. And that sculpture captures the flower's natural life cycle, from buds to blossoms, reminding us of both the fragility and the resilience of life.
Dr. Calvin Ball is the county executive for Howard County, Maryland, my home county. They recently unveiled a memorial to those who were lost during the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as everybody impacted by it, especially healthcare workers and all the essential folks without whom we wouldn't have been able to make it through at all. Dr. Ball, what an inspiring story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us today here in North Dakota on Prairie Public.
It's quite an honor, and I hope that it brings people, especially during this holiday season, a little bit more peace, a little bit more thankfulness, and a little bit more connection. God bless you all.
Coming up in the second half of Main Street, Craig Blumenschein talks with a couple of advocates trying to get the issue of free school lunches for everyone on the ballot in North Dakota. And we'll talk to a University of North Dakota aviation student who is inspiring women and girls in her home country of Mali. Stay tuned.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Snowfall is wrapping up across the state as North Dakota's first winter storm of the year blows through the area. Matthew Johnson is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Bismarck. He says southeastern North Dakota is currently receiving the heaviest snowfalls as it tapers off everywhere else. He says gusty winds are also blowing it around and making visibility less than ideal, although it is worse down in South Dakota.
Actually, across the border in South Dakota, they're experiencing blizzard conditions. We don't have as strong of winds as they have right now. So we're more of just heavy snow with some breezy winds, which are still reducing visibilities. But as you go further south, they're getting more snow and stronger winds down there.
Johnson says he expects the snow to continue to taper off through the night, but lingering fog could make travel difficult tomorrow in eastern portions of North Dakota. He says it looks to be quiet on Thanksgiving Day, but they are also monitoring another system that may produce another winter storm this weekend. He says if you must travel, monitor road and weather reports and be prepared.
Yeah, just make sure that you're properly packed, that you got everything you need, because the roads could be slippery until they're cleared off. Especially with this cold weather lingering. And then make sure you pack the proper attire, especially with these cold temperatures lingering. We're expecting maybe even some below zero temperatures and some minus 20 wind chills early next week. So just be cognizant of all of the things going on.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You are listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge, a proud grad of the aviation program at the University of North Dakota. And today, I'm honored to speak with a fellow UND aviation student, a current one who is charting a course to make history by becoming the first female commercial pilot in her home country, Mali. Numuso Diane, bonjour.
Bonjour. Thank you so much, Eric. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. So first off, where are you in your studies now? Like, how many flight hours do you have? What planes are you flying at the moment?
Right now, I'm flying the Piper Archer, and I'm working on my commercial and my multi-engine. I have about 200 hours.
So when are you expected to graduate?
The goal is fall 2026.
So I'm curious, thinking about Mali, is there a national flag carrier and airline of Mali right now that you one day hope to fly with, or would you like to fly somewhere else?
Well, we used to have a national airline called Air Mali that kind of died at some point, and it came back. They call it Sky Mali now. I hope one day I'll be able to fly for them. That's the goal. West Africa, East Africa, anywhere in Africa or anywhere in the world. But Mali is the main place, honestly.
So you'd like to go home to Mali and fly for one of your airlines in Mali. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let's go back. Let's rewind to when you were very young and growing up in Mali. Did you dream about becoming a pilot when you were very young?
Everything started, it was when I was five, honestly. When I was five and I had that trip with my mom to Timbuktu to visit my dad on the job site. We were the only people on that plane for some reason. And when we got there, the pilot came out and they showed me around. They were really sweet and all that. That's how I fell in love with it. That's how I was like, you know what? That's what I want to do one day.
Now, I know your parents are the most supportive people in your corner, among many who are, but what was your dad's initial reaction when you told him about your dream of becoming a pilot?
Well, he thought it was kind of funny, not in a mean way, but more like we don't really have female pilot back home. So when I said that, I think he was thinking more like, oh, this is a wild dream, but he was still proud and very supportive and all that. So after his reaction, I kept thinking about it because the whole time I was thinking, oh, I'm sure we have female pilot for sure. Like, this is 2020. I don't even know. But yeah. So yeah, after doing some research, I was like, wait, we actually don't have female pilot. Okay, that's interesting. I see why my dad was reacting like that now.
So did that make you more determined than ever that that's what you wanted to do, to become that first female pilot in Mali?
When I found that, it was scary. At first it was scary, but at the same time, I was excited. I was more like, yes, we are going to do that. We can't only let men stay in that industry. So, yeah.
Well, you know, on a serious note, I mean, the educational opportunities for girls in Mali, you know, was quite limited at the time, even in the 2020s. What was the typical career and life path like for women and girls in Mali?
So you go to school, then when you get maybe, let's say, 15 to 18 years old, you start thinking about marriage and find a husband. You can continue your school after that, but most of the time, you know, with family life and all that, women will just decide to stop and stay at home. So that's kind of what I've been seeing. But I also had the opposite with my mom, for example, who's she was a judge. She just retired. So I could see, okay, we have other options. I can do something else to not only stay at home and just be a mom, or, you know, which is great too, honestly. I still want to be a wife. I still want to be a mom.
You are listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge, and if you're just joining us, we are talking to Numuso Diane, who will become the first female commercial aviation pilot in Mali. She's currently studying for her commercial pilot's license at the University of North Dakota. So your journey to the University of North Dakota, I'm very curious about that. It actually sort of went a roundabout way via Montana. How did you wind up there, and how did you eventually make your way to UND?
When I was in high school, 10th grade, I decided to apply for an exchange program called Kennedy Lugar Youth Exchange and Study. Then I came to the U.S. in 2018 for my 11th grade to stay here for 10 months. I was hosted in Montana, Whitefish, Montana. Yeah, I stayed there for 10 months. Great people, great town. I still love going back there. From there, I went back home for my last year in high school. And then my dad asked me about my plan for college. And I was like, you know what? I really like the education system in the U.S. And if possible, I would love to go back and continue my studies. Then I started looking for school. I started with Montana, actually, because that's what I knew. Then I compare it with other schools around to see the price and, you know, tuition, see how expensive or, you know, all that. And even my program, because when I started, I wanted to do petroleum engineering, not aviation. Then I found UND, and UND is also really, really good or great with engineering in general. And compared to the school in Montana, it was more affordable. So I decided to come to UND, and this is how I got here.
Well, when you got here, I mean, you had to be, you know, just being around campus, going to the, I guess, western part of campus and seeing the UND, Odegaard School for Aviation, all the facilities, even that's before you get to the airport and see their flight operations. Did something there sort of grab your imagination?
When I got here, I didn't even know about the airport, the aviation part, honestly. Let me be honest. I didn't know about it at all. I started making friends, and most of them were aviation students, and they were always talking about aviation, always fly that, always aviation that. And I was like, okay, I really like what you guys are doing. But since I picked this, I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to see what I can do here. Even though after, I think, my first class, I was not feeling it. I was not feeling like this is my place. This is what I want to do. That's when I started thinking, wait, when you started, you wanted to be a pilot. Remember when you were younger? And I had a whole conversation with my dad about it. So yeah, after seeing, then I decided to visit go to the airport with one of my friends. And that's where I saw all the planes, how organized it was, people so excited. I was like, oh my God, I want to be here. This is exactly why I'm here.
Wow.
And yeah.
Oh yeah, it's so impressive out there. I mean, it's one of the busiest airports in the country, by golly. It's, you know, just all the...
It is.
Yeah, it's wild. So you just get such an experience with the different, obviously, the atmospheric conditions and the weather here. You can't sort of beat the training. It's a very challenging environment, maybe the most challenging you could train at. So what have been some of your flight training highlights so far, like your first solo, first cross-country? Describe some of that to us.
I would say my first solo, it's true that I was very excited and couldn't wait for my instructor to let me go. But then when I was alone about to take off, that's when it really kicked in. I realized, okay, you're alone here, but you got this. I was nervous, like, yeah. But then when I started taking off, and then I was up there flying alone, the whole time I was just like, am I really flying? I'm alone. I'm doing this for real. I can't believe it. And I feel like the whole time my instructor was just there, like, praying, okay, she got this.
Well, you know, there's no time really to think and ponder about this big moment because you have to talk to the air traffic controllers. You got to figure out where you are, when you're going to turn your base and final and all that. But, I mean, it's hard not to think about what a moment that was. And when you landed, like, what was the feeling when you shut down the engine, you got out of the plane, and you're like, whew.
Well, landing first, when I was coming from base, base to final, I was like, okay, you've been doing this, got this, don't think too much, you're trained for that. Then when I landed and then meeting my instructor, he was so excited and I was also so excited. I'm like, yes, I did it and all that. I was so proud. I just wanted to call everybody back home. Oh my God, I flew a plane by myself. Nobody was there. So yeah, that was really fulfilling.
Oh, I bet it was. Now, in my day, when you first soloed, they rip your shirt and they put it on a wall. What do they do now?
Now they just give you that big sign saying your first solo and take a picture. The ATC, they gave me my call sign thing. They gave it to my instructor to give it to me. And that's what I still have.
Oh, that's very cool. That's very cool. Something you'll never forget. So at the University of North Dakota, not only are you involved in the aviation program, but campus life in general. Can you tell us some of the organizations that you belong to?
Yes. Right now, I was the vice president for OBAP, the Organization of Black Aerospace Professionals. Then this semester, I'm the president. I'm also involved with ASU, the African Students Union, and Women in Aviation.
So how does it feel to you to be an inspiration to girls back home in Mali? Do you feel a pressure, a weight?
I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I feel that, I feel that pressure about you can't fail. You're not doing that for only yourself. Our people are watching. I shouldn't put all that on myself. I should also enjoy my time. I should also do that for myself and show to other girls that, you know, I know it's stressful. I know you have pressure and all that, but you can still do it.
Well, I'm sure you must feel a sense of pride as well to be a pioneer. You're going to be the first commercial female aviation pilot in Mali. Wow, congratulations, Numuso Diane, who is an aviation student at UND. And thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on all your success and best wishes for an amazing career.
Thank you so much, Ernie.
Today's programming is made possible in part by John and Jeannie Mahacek, in appreciation of kindness and empathy.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we're tackling a topic that hits close to home for many families, and that's school lunches. In North Dakota, thousands of children rely on free or reduced price meals every day. In fact, after a recent expansion of eligibility, roughly 37,000 students in our public schools are now eligible for free lunches, including about 2,000 kids who previously fell through the cracks of federal aid. Yet advocates say many children in need still aren't reached, and schools often absorb meal debt when families can't pay. During the pandemic, every student received free school meals thanks to federal support, and many saw firsthand how that leveled the playing field at lunchtime. But when that program ended, North Dakota returned to the old system where only some students qualified for assistance since then. Joining me are two guests today on the forefront of the issue, Amy Jacobson. She's the executive director of Prairie Action ND, which is helping lead a coalition for free school meals. Amy, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
And Robin Nelson, she's the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of the Red River Valley and also serves as a Fargo School Board member. Robin, welcome.
Thank you so much, Craig. I have to start every interview with a disclaimer that I am neither speaking on behalf of the Fargo School Board, nor am I speaking on behalf of the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Red River Valley.
So noted. All right. We do want to talk about the issue, though. We'll talk about the history of school lunches here and why both of you now believe now's the time to take the issue directly to the voters. And Robin and Amy, I should stress, this is not just a Fargo issue, right? This is an issue that impacts our entire state. And maybe either of you can give us some background on why it's equally important in rural Western North Dakota as it is here in the Fargo area.
Well, we know that food insecurity is not a Fargo issue. It is a statewide issue. In fact, we know that in all 53 counties in North Dakota, food security affects families in every single one of those communities. And I think we have numbers from the 2023 report from Great Plains Food Bank that showed 1 in 3 kids in North Dakota is getting some food from the Great Plains Food Bank. And those numbers are increasing, especially in recent months. So there has been some national momentum of other states, you know, putting this in front of the voters because the people and the families want preschool meals for their kids. In fact, polls have been reported in North Dakota over the past year, nearly 80% of voters want this for our kids because it means another $1,000 per child back in a family's pocketbook per year. And that money is really going to help out in other ways.
Take us into what you've heard from the legislature. I think some would argue, hey, we did expand eligibility slightly in the last session. It's up maybe 225% of poverty level. Can you walk us through what's happened with the legislature recently and why you still feel there needs to be broader support for free meals for all?
You know, we still, even after that legislation was passed, nearly half of food insecure children in North Dakota are still ineligible for those federal programs.
I think some people would find Amy's stats shocking that they just heard that 1 in 3 North Dakota kids get food from a food bank. That's startling to me, and I followed this issue back in my home state in Wyoming and here in North Dakota for quite some time. Do people really get that, Amy, in your mind?
There is obviously stigma and shame around being food insecure, and especially, you know, when you're in more rural communities. So one of the things, that's why we feel it's so important to make sure that all, you know, students receive access to meals at school. That reduces any stigma, any shame. It levels of balancing, you know, the playing field, make sure that all those kids get food when they're at school and that they can be productive members. But it is shocking. It is very shocking. And I think that we must know on some level that it is so prevalent because so many people are supportive of passing a measure like this.
We even heard in the last session, students testifying about this issue. One saying they felt blessed to have this help when they needed it the most. These are real children in our communities. Robin, as working directly with kids through Boys and Girls Club, how is it your perception that hunger impacts the classroom? You talked about attendance. You wonder about the environment of after school, participating in athletics when you're hungry. What have you noticed?
When kids are hungry, we know that their behavior issues rise. I mean, you can use the term hangry. As adults, we know how to handle that, but maybe kids that are younger don't. If we can preemptively prevent some of that escalated behavior, everybody's going to benefit. Not just that child, but the entire classroom. The kids that I work with, they don't want people to know that they're in need, and it's an embarrassment for them. To the point where we change our fundraising for the Boys and Girls Club to talk about a strength-based messaging because our kids were starting to find out and they didn't want to be thought of as a charity. So there's a lot of pride here, not only with our kids, but with our families. We have families that refuse to apply for assistance and would rather have their kids go hungry. And we've seen it, and it's really heartbreaking to watch. I have stories like this on a daily basis, all the way from kindergarten up through seniors in high school.
Well, I would like to add that, you know, additionally, you think about that amount of money back in the pocketbooks of our working families, that $1,000 per kid per year, what that means for them, like now that they don't have to worry about putting it out for their school meals, that allows them to invest in other things for that their children need, whether it's the extracurriculars or sometimes it's special ed programming and other things that they need. And it just goes back into our community, makes our families stronger. So I just think it's really important to remember that it helps their behavior. It keeps their food in their bellies. It keeps them more productive. School is, you know, it's better for everybody, and it's better for the families as well.
I'm enjoying my conversation with Amy Jacobson. You just heard from her. She's the executive director of Prairie Action ND, which is helping lead a coalition for free school meals. Also with us today is Robin Nelson, who is the CEO of Boys and Girls Club of the Red River Valley and also serves as a Fargo school board member. I want to talk about the ballot measure both of you are working on now to the voters. Can you explain what the proposed measure would do?
Our proposed measure is a constitutional amendment to the North Dakota State Constitution that would guarantee access to free breakfast and lunch for all enrolled students in North Dakota. It would also provide an opt-in for schools that are like private schools and others that may not currently be participating in the National Federal School Meal Program. It's got a lot more components, not a lot more, it's actually a pretty simple ballot measure, but we just make sure that our schools are participating in the national program so that as a state, we can make the best, take the best advantages of the reimbursement program. And then we allow, the ballot measure allows the state to decide how to fund it so that they can look at all the different streaming opportunities for funding and make the best choice for North Dakota. We do have a backstop that if there are not funds available or they need to tap another source, a secondary source would be the state's North Dakota Legacy Fund earnings.
Tell me then why now is the right time in your mind, Robin, to do this?
Well, we came off of the two prior legislative sessions. We have really come to the conclusion that we're not going to get that much more movement. That has been made very clear to us. And so we are so passionate about this, as are so many residents in North Dakota. This is just the logical next step. I mean, we have nowhere else to go. Giving up is not an option. So this is the only other option, and this is the solution to so many things in our state, and our state residents want it, and we're going to do the work to get it done.
I'm sure there's a price tag for this. What do you estimate it might be?
Yeah, we estimate $140 million over the biennium, $70 million per year.
There are kids who are homeschooled in North Dakota. There are kids now that go to charter schools. There are kids that go to private schools. Are they all, or will they all have the potential to be included in what you're proposing?
I'll answer that question. So yes. So all public schools and charter schools, private schools, and others have the opportunity to either be required if they're the public schools or opt in if they're the private schools.
Some people, when they think about the cost, have said, look, if we make free meals available for everyone, then we're paying for kids from families who can afford to buy lunch. How do you respond to folks who have thought about that?
I would say that this is really an investment in the whole community. When every child is fed, we remove stigma, we simplify the system, and we boost school participation. We have the improved learning, health, and equity. And then these universal school meal programs, just due to their participation, they eventually have the side effects to help the community and their classrooms, such as less disruption, increased concentration on studies, and we can invest now or we can pay later for some of the shortfalls that we could have prevented. And so I do think that this is a long-term strategy along with a short-term strategy. We are investing in our future North Dakota residents. I would also say that if I were to find out, if I was looking for a job in North Dakota and they had free meals, that would be something that would be ticked off on a list.
Amy, what are your thoughts of the folks who say, look, kids who come from family of means don't need this. Therefore, I don't think it's a great idea for our state. What would you tell those folks?
What I would tell those folks is that by providing free school meals to all of our kids, we're really leveling the playing field for all of our students. We're creating an environment that supports all of our students. And that benefits those parents as well. Wealthy parents who maybe can pay on their own, they will have that $1,000 kind of lunch, what do they call it, you know, that lunchbox tax break back in their pocket as well to be able to invest in other educational components for their students. So really it's good for all students that will be treated all in the same way and all be receiving the benefits of the healthy, nutritious school meals.
Ladies, let's talk logistics and timeline. What needs to happen for this measure to appear on North Dakota's ballot, and when would voters potentially see it, and what can they do if they support it?
So there's a little bit of a logistics involved right now. We are formally submitting our language and sponsoring committee to the Secretary of State's office this week. There is an amount of time in which they review it, and then when they provide it back to us with the official language is when we're go time. We're out there collecting signatures from anybody who wants to see this on the ballot, and we expect that to happen fairly swiftly. So, you know, in the next month or two, you know, we'll be out in the community collecting signatures, and then we'll keep collecting those signatures until we have the required 32,000 plus, you know, to submit to the Secretary of State's office. There's a process they go through, and then it will be, hopefully, all things done well, which we intend to do, on the ballot in November 2026 for the voters to be able to vote into law.
So this is 32,000 signatures of whom? What qualifies one to sign a petition?
A North Dakota resident who can vote in any other election, that has a driver's license or state-issued ID that they use for voting, can sign the petition.
Correct. Yes. Any eligible voter in North Dakota is able to put their name on the signature so we can move it towards the ballot.
Do you project there will be opposition to this measure?
There's always going to be some opposition, but we think that the momentum in support will far outweigh that. We know we're going to get a lot of hits and digs on this, but we're just going to keep speaking the positive impacts of this happening and have faith on the number of North Dakotans that support it. I think there's a pretty good chance if we do get this on the ballot, it will pass easily.
I would also add that we know that there's incredibly broad support for this work here in North Dakota, and it's something that crosses the political spectrum. It crosses regions, it crosses economic backgrounds. All kinds of people are saying that they're in support of this. And that's why we're really excited to be bringing it to the people, because it's a big unifier for people in North Dakota to come together with a shared vision for our future and be able to vote that into law for our kids.
For listeners who really care about this issue, what can they do to get involved or learn more? School Meals for All is a good idea. How can they support your efforts or find more information about the proposed initiative? And is there a way for people to share stories or to help gather support across the state?
All of the above. Right now, we're in the formative stages. We're really focused on getting our ballot language written and getting everything handed in. So for the time being, you can go to the website at togetherforschoolmeals.org, scroll down and sign up for the newsletter. And then we will keep you updated every step of the way. There's going to be a lot of work to do, and we need everybody's help to do it. So the sooner you can sign up, the sooner you're going to get that information.
It's been my pleasure to have Amy Jacobson of Prairie Action ND and Robin Nelson, who's acting in her personal capacity. She's also the chairman of the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of the Red River Valley and also a member of the Fargo School Board. Thank you both for sharing your insights today. It's a topic I think that really blends policy and personal experience, budgets and ballots. We hear about that all the time, but it's all about kids not going hungry. To both of you, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
And that's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street on this wintry kind of day. Hopefully that stays away tomorrow on the busiest travel day of the year. Speaking of that, we're going to share some stories from Prairie Public employees about their travel nightmares. So hope you listen in for that. In the meantime, have yourself a great rest of your Tuesday.